In case you weren't here last week, we had a guest preacher, a New Testament professor from Auckland University, Elaine Wainwright. And the theme of her sermon was essentially that there is an inconvenient truth in how Jesus preached eternal life, that it's not something out in the future. It's something that can be grasped today. Even more inconvenient, it's not eternal life isn't harps and angels' wings. It's about living an ethical life. This week, we get a glimpse of the implications of that truth. James and John have just made an end run around their mates to grab power. If we can't be number one, make sure the one who is depends on us. Their power and honor and glory have to rub off somewhere. Might as well be on us. It's a perfectly natural desire, even if it is wiser not to own up to it. Many a preacher today will give a fine sermon about James and John's, how they don't get it. Seeking upward mobility is not the route to eternal life. As worthy of a sermon as that would be, that isn't the sermon you get to hear. One of the interesting ramifications of having a major theological shift in your life, I am discovering, is that you don't read familiar passages in the same comfortable way. When your theology no longer has room for an external, personal God somewhere out there, when your view of Jesus is that he is more or less human than ourselves, it becomes difficult to simply accept without question the gospel's account of his words and actions. The gospels are not an account of his life. They are the early church's interpretation and explanation of that life. They are written from the perspective of 2020 hindsight and with the benefit of untold hours of theological reflection. His followers are trying to make sense of this man who did not behave according to expected norms. They are colored by what was happening in the Christian community at the time and the challenges they were facing trying to follow him. Like a pebble in your shoe, his life kept irritating them, challenging the way they understood the world to be, or at least wanted it to be. The Gospels reflect our human need to resolve uncomfortable tension in our lives by putting Jesus in a box we can make sense of. The Son of God box is what they used. And for the next 2,000 years, generations of followers just accepted their work and conclusion without doing the work for themselves in their own context. Unfortunately, their conclusions no longer make sense for me. I know this because Jesus irritates me more now than ever. It is annoying to me that at age 57, I have to re-examine my worldview. He has slipped out of the box, and he is raising havoc with all my carefully shaped assumptions. I long for when I could accept the traditional view that he was an instrument of a personal God cleaning up the mess we've made of things, relieving me of all responsibility except of acknowledging him as Lord. This view let me off the hook. Jesus, by this interpretation, is one of a kind, instead of an example of what each of us is capable. There is no way I can emulate the one of a kind Jesus. Besides, I don't have to. That Jesus has already done my work for me. My former view let me slip into focusing on the differences between the one-of-a-kind Jesus and us, instead of our similarities with the historical Jesus. I could look at James and John's all too human tendency to climb over the backs of others for personal gain and go, tisk, tisk. People like them are the problem with the world today. Just look at Bush and Blair. At least when I'm trying to shine up my CV, I'm trying to make the world a better place. That was such a self-satisfying way to read the gospel. But if I have to look at my capacity to be Jesus, my focus has to shift from James and John to what Jesus was about. Today's gospel is more likely about some power struggle happening in the infant church at the time Mark was writing it than about what Jesus really said or did on the road to Jerusalem. I suspect this because while a human Jesus certainly knew he was becoming a dangerous irritant to the authorities, which did not bode well for him, he had no way of knowing what the outcome would be at the end of the story. He certainly hadn't already sent out invitations to the Last Supper to which he refers. What does come through, though, of the human Jesus in Mark's account is that he apparently wasn't interested in proving or using earthly or heavenly power, even for his own holy purposes. This character trait, preserved in the collective memory of those who followed him and passed on to others, is probably for real. It is certainly an inconvenient memory for the church to preserve, as it was busy structuring itself in a hierarchical manner similar to the emperor's court. If this characteristic wasn't as undeniable as it is inconvenient, it surely would have been edited out at some point. After all, power and authority would become the bread and butter of the church, justified by its godly desire to be the gateway to heaven. It's a tough job, but somebody's got to do it. What is striking about this memory of Jesus is his not being flattered by James and John's recognition of his being a rising star and their desire to tie their wagons to it. How abnormal. His leadership style doesn't seem to need them. Yet don't leaders need loyal followers? Parents need children. Teachers need students. Doctors need patients. And preachers need congregations. Jesus' example says, apparently not. Now that's irritating. This Jesus seems to recognize that human interaction is fraught with conflict because each of us wants our own way. But the only way any of us can achieve this outcome is if others choose to be, or are forced to be, subservient to our will. That seems to be a great solution for the one whose will is being met, but is less satisfactory for the one who has had to put their desires on hold. As we have all had times when we have not gotten our way, I assume, we know the resentment and envy this engenders. We put up with it in the hope that someday we will get to impose our will. The world says that's the way it has to be. Better that some of us get our way than none at all. This Jesus says, not so. Getting your own way isn't all it's cracked up to be. The superior one has to live with the knowledge that getting their way requires someone else giving up theirs. They need that person. They need them to recognize their superiority in order to have it. As there is always the possibility they will no longer do so, or will demand that turnabout is fair play, they become a threat, but a threat that they need. This can lead to loathing and contempt. The superior person knows there is no difference between himself and the one he depends on to maintain his position. The natural response, then, is to diminish the other so as to justify their place in the general order. The proof of this is everywhere. Look at how women have been traditionally treated by men. Or pakeha, often referred to mori. Or how straights denigrate gays and lesbians. Or Christians who portray those who believe differently. The problem with diminishing others is that we are diminished as well. Jesus' leadership style invites us to avoid this ultimately destructive trap. By not needing others to fulfill us and define us, we no longer need to seek domination. Our power and authority come from within. We are not dependent on others. How else could the master wash the disciples' feet and not be diminished? He invites others to follow. He doesn't force them. They maintain free will and the capacity to choose. He loses nothing if they don't. He teaches those who wish to be his students. But if they don't, he is no less a teacher. He offers eternal life for our sake. He does not require it for his own. This Jesus did not create this truth. He simply lives it. Even as he is denied, rejected, and executed, he is still not diminished. By the world's standards, he is hardly a sterling example of leadership. I suppose that is the most annoying thing about the man. That is why he remains for me an itch I can't quite reach. We know he's right. We all know leaders who form leaders. We all know doctors who make their patients well. We all know parents who raise their children to leave home. We all know teachers who graduate their students. I suppose the only question left is, do we know any preachers who don't want their congregation to show up next week because they are too busy living eternal life? There is always the chance this could happen. If Jesus was capable of living this way, so are we. So if next week Glenn asks where everybody is, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.